All right. Hello and welcome to the Crypto Explorer. It's a podcast by Sygnum Bank, designed to bring you closer to the world of crypto and to the future of finance. I'm your host, Alia Dasgupta, and today I'm so happy to be joined in our studio by Munir Benshamled from Paraswap and Martin Booger from Sygnum Bank. Today we're going to be talking about DEXs, DEX aggregators, and what really this new infrastructure is bringing to the world of crypto. And also perhaps a little bit about how this is going to influence the retail world, the traditional finance world, and the road ahead. So Munir, do you want to kick us off with a quick introduction?
Thanks, guys, for having me. It's a big pleasure being here. So I'm founder of Paraswap. I have a technical background. I used to be an engineer, worked at a startups and big companies before. Spent maybe most of the time working at a transportation company as we were a company, and started being connected to crypto in around 2013, mostly on the technical side, but got all in 2017, as many people did the same, and went to multiple iteration in the beginning, mostly trading, investing in crypto, in tokens. Then in 2018, I left my job just to build something in crypto. I wasn't even sure what I wanted to do exactly. So I experimented a few things, then started being more interested in building on DEXs, which led me to build Paraswap, and the rest is history.
Fantastic. And Paraswap's had such a big impact for only being around for a couple of years. And the journey is just fantastic to hear about. So we'll probably cover some more of this, but first, Martin.
Yes, so I'm Martin Burker, Chief Clients Officer of Sygnum Bank. With Sygnum Bank now for 3.5 years. And actually, I'm probably more on the user side of these DEXs. And I well remember, and you mentioned, like, you really got into the crypto game in 2017. I also got in late 16, beginning of 17. And I also still very, very well remember the user experience of, like, an Ether Delta or the likes, which was the best in class DEX that was available back then. And now if you look at how fast actually things evolve with, like, a Uniswap, which provides like an experience which is 100 times better than the one of Ether Delta, and now with 1-inch and Paraswap with DEX aggregators, which actually provide really, really deep liquidity, well, of course, particularly in the blue chips, but also even with some mid-cap coins, that's really exciting to see. And I'm very happy to be here today and discuss a bit what is the latest greatest in the DeFi aggregators, and also what is next, because, like, when you see how fast the pace is, then I think when we are in 2025, we will look back and say, you know, actually, well, it was probably quite okay in 2022, but still, like, what you have now is just much, much more exciting, right? It's a fast pace, and I'm looking forward to see how this evolves further over the next couple of years.
Awesome. Thanks for that. And I think as we kick off, I mean, for our listeners, I think perhaps not everyone is familiar with what is a DEX fundamentally, and maybe a super high level overview. Munir, do you want to?
Yeah, well, a DEX is, first of all, an exchange. It's a place where we can buy and sell crypto. Most of the DEXs started actually on Ethereum, but now we see more and more blockchains have their own DEXs. So the main difference between, say, a Binance, which we call it a centralized exchange, and a Uniswap, which is a decentralized exchange, so there's like the C and D that makes the difference between both, is the DEX doesn't have custody of user funds. For instance, in Binance, users have to deposit and trust that Binance will secure their crypto, while in DEXs, there is a separation between trading and custody. So users, they bring their own wallets. It can be also custodial or non-custodial, but there is a borderline between both. So the DEX at the end is a software, is a pure software that all it does is finding or matching the liquidity with the end user. So I would say that's at a high level. What is the difference is, especially on the custody side, where DEXs never have custody of user funds, they are completely agnostic to that.
Perfect. And Martin, would you add anything to that? Or?
No, I think it explains it quite well. I think there is also a slight difference. Like, I think from centralized exchanges, we are rather used to like order books. So we really see like what kind of volume is placed at a certain price. Whereas it's more a dynamic curve, basically, which is underlying to the most of the DEXs that I'm familiar with, which really depend on how much liquidity did users add to the pool. But there is not actually an order book per se there, but it's more an order book which is calculated based on the liquidity. I think that's also a bit of a difference. But otherwise, of course, the key advantage is really, if you believe in decentralization, if you want to have the own custody, if you don't want to trust the central party to do the matching and to custodize, I think it's very attractive to have this possibility of these decentralized exchange. They also don't require, for example, a listing, but everyone can actually list the token who is willing to provide liquidity, right? That's also a key advantage. That's actually, I think this was the key value proposition of Ether Delta, that it was now also the key value proposition of an Uniswap, that actually the centralized exchange, they have so much power in saying, you know, whoever comes to, who wants to come to our exchange needs to pay a certain amount, or we want to have this kind of side deal or the likes. But that on Uniswap, Swap, it's just everyone who wants can actually use this software piece, provide liquidity, and then there is liquidity and an exchange for a certain token. And I think that's a very attractive value proposition that these decentralized exchanges are actually offering.
Yeah, I mean, for better or for worse, basically any kind of crappy token can find a liquidity exchange.
I mean, it doesn't stop centralized exchanges from doing the same at the end.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, arguably, I think centralized exchanges are also doing this for several, like, questionable coins. Yeah. So,
exactly.
Uniswap isn't better or for worse. So, Munir, you were saying you were working in tech, and then sometime in 2017, you said, I see an opportunity here that doesn't exist, or there's some way to optimize something better. And you decided to create a DEX aggregator. How did that happen?
Yeah, so 2017 was like the year where you couldn't miss crypto. Everyone, I mean, was talking about crypto to an extent. So it became more of an obsession where I spent all my free time on crypto. Sometimes even during lunch times, I would like read the white papers and like spend my time on crypto, which was like a clear, I would say, love story that started really, really at that time. And in the beginning of 2018, this is where I left. And Martin, I was a big user of Ether Delta. It was the easiest place where you can sell the whatever ICO tokens we bought, if they are not listed on a Binance immediately. So yeah, but obviously I was like mostly everyone very frustrated with their user experience and slowness and all of that. And there was a big centralization element to it. So I said, maybe we have a product market fit that users are really using and it's processing a decent volume. So why not build a better Ether, like a real product that looks like centralized exchanges, but is decentralized, more decentralized than the Ether Delta. That was the initial thoughts I had in like late 2018. And by the moment I was barely starting to work on it, well, AMM started to take off. Bancor, Kyber, Uniswap was just launched. They launched it like late November 2018. And so we had like 3-4 DEXs, and I was like, okay, instead of adding again another DEX and adding more fragmentation to like a small, each one was having like $1 million in liquidity at max, and when they processed like 100k a day, it was a day that everyone would celebrate. $1 million was like the combined volume for everyone. So I was like, okay, if we have $1 million for 4 DEXs, combining the 4 or the 5, it will give us $5 million in liquidity that users will have access to. So why not build an aggregator that's going to combine the liquidity of all and give a user a better service than them going to every single DEX and not finding, or like not being well served. So that was the idea that I started in like late Q2 of 2019. But I said, okay, why not do something more interesting, is make this a retail product, something that will be competing with a Coinbase that everyone can use with just the push of a button, and people don't need to know the underlying complexity of blockchain and stuff. So I built an MVP And it got a lot of excitement, but it wasn't successful at all. And nobody was using this because, well, the approach was very naive. And I got some questions like, well, I don't see Bitcoin. How can I put my credit card and all of that, which gave me this insight that this is way too early for the markets. There are still a lot of barriers to entry. And this is just not the right timing. That product would make a lot of sense nowadays, but this is 2019, only 3 years ago, but it seems like forever in crypto. So, which led me to pivot into building a product for the DeFi niche. At that time, DeFi was like 3,000 people on a Telegram group. That's, if you see literally all DeFi in there, a lot of builders, enthusiasts about decentralization and decentralized finance. So this is what we're really Parasoft started in making trading on-chain better and introducing more efficiency, but not for everyone. It's mostly building an infrastructure for existing builders and early adopters, and in the future for other dApps and wallet that will provide this technology to their users. So that's how Parasoft evolved in this short period of time.
Wow. The whole journey across several years, right? I guess from a user perspective, and maybe I'll field this one to Martin, like when you go into a DEX, so when you're looking to swap between different coins, like what are the features that you're looking for? And then we can maybe see if that aligns with the ideas that Munir also considered while he was building.
Well, I think like Munir explained, I think a lot comes down to the user experience. So, for example, what I think the DEX, for example, that I still use the most is probably Uniswap. And what I like about Uniswap really, like you connect the wallet, you select this coin from a dropdown, you get the price. I also like the transparency so that you, for example, can see when you want to convert one coin into USDC and there is no direct USDC pair, that you can actually see that we first swap into Ether and then Ether into USDC or into DAI and the like. So I like the transparency. I think I also like the transparency on the slippage so that you can see exactly so what is the price slippage that you actually get when you execute a certain transaction. That's for me also a very important feature because you don't want to assume that you can liquidate a position to $1,500 per Ether and then you find out after you execute the trade you actually just got $1,400 per Ether. That's something that you don't want, and for me hence also important that you have the slippage indicator. And I think that's already it. And I think, well, overall, I think also it's for me important that the platform somehow doesn't look shady, right? There is still this, it's a bit a new space, still, well, new, I mean, new compared to traditional finance. It's of course still very new when we talk about 5 years from Ether Delta or like 3 years from Uniswap. So it's still quite new. So for me, it's also important that like the platform somehow looks like that I can trust it, because ultimately, yes, you sign transaction, you send these coins then to these DEXs, and if something would go wrong in this swap process, you would of course be very unpleased. So I think that's for me also as a user, this trustworthiness is also an element which I'm always looking for, also when I try something new.
I mean, I think that's one of the big differentiators as well, right? Like if something does go wrong in your engagement with Uniswap, it's not like there's a customer care helpline that you can call and say, hey, I don't see my funds in my wallet, where are they? That's also something that's hard to build in an ecosystem, right? Like that's not something that you want to see advertisements like, this is the most trustworthy exchange, please come and trade over here.
No, then you need to be careful. Yeah. No, it's for me it's more the look and feel, right? Like, yes, how does it look? Does it feel to be something credible? It's more the look and feel. But for me as a user, the look and feel of a platform is very, well, A, it needs to be simple, and B, it needs to somehow, yes, not be too flashy. I don't want to feel like I'm in a casino, right? It should do what it's supposed to do, but not much more. And that's, for example, also what I like about Uniswap, for example. It's just, it's clean, it's lean, it's simple, down to the minimum, and I think that's also what I like as a user. But I think there are also different preferences. But I personally, I don't like when it's too much flashy and too much casino, because then I always think, well, it has probably a bit of a shady touch. And for me, the slippage is really something which I'm actually well, very cautious about. And that's then also when I actually use DEX aggregators, when I just want to make sure that I have more liquidity. If I also, well, I think for me, for the blue chips, it's of course not an issue. But for mid caps, sometimes you can really get significantly better executions if you use DEX aggregators. And I think that's for me then also when I'm using them. You know.
I think that's kind of an interesting point. Like, that's for me to understand as well, right? Like, so when you want to swap something, you go to a Uniswap and not to a Paraswap or to an aggregator that arguably will be getting you the best price across multiple exchanges?
I think, well, for the very liquid pairs, I think the difference between going to a DEX and going to a DEX aggregator is, I think, arguably very, very limited. But I think, yes, the more exotic the pair gets or the less the liquidity gets of the token that you want to trade, of course, the more sense it makes to go to actually Uniswap. I think for me, it's more, I'm very used to actually going to Uniswap, but I often also like compare and see, okay, what is now the best price that I can get from a Paraswap or from a 1-inch and from a Uniswap. But it's probably more a bit, I think some users, they have bookmarked Uniswap as the first entry point. Others, they bookmarked Paraswap, and I think there is no right or wrong. But when I trade less liquid tokens, then I always actually go to a DEX aggregator.
Right. Munir, how does this align with all the factors that you've considered while building Paraswap?
Am I doing the right thing?
Well, I would say it depends. Yes, Uniswap is quite big. I mean, it is the biggest exchange so far. You will most likely make good trades if you, as you said, use high cap tokens like ETH, USDC, USDT. So I would say, like, you will likely not lose money unless you're making like really big amounts, like, I don't know, $1 million worth of ETH to DAI. Maybe even if it's a high cap token, it's still better to use an aggregator. But also using direct Uniswap, what we're doing is re-optimizing Uniswap. So even if the trade goes to Uniswap only, it's gonna use a specific router, and that router is cheaper than the Uniswap router, because Uniswap nowadays, and that's the case for most of the DEXs, they build their own router. So they are like aggregators inside the DEX itself. You can see it as like if you're booking an airline ticket from, I don't know, Paris to New York through Air France or whatever airline company. Well, maybe the same company has a direct flight, or maybe the same company will tell you, hey, maybe go through London, then to New York, because that combination is better. Maybe you will lose a little bit of time, but the price or the cost is much cheaper, significantly cheaper. Or maybe the timing you're requesting is not available for a direct flight. So this kind of optimizations can be done inside the same platform. And here we're talking about airline tickets or Uniswap or any DEX. They do something equivalent, where Uniswap will say, okay, let's trade, sell ETH to USDC, and then sell the USDC to DAI in order, but all of that inside Uniswap. So this is looks a lot like what we're doing at Paraswap, like as an aggregator, but Uniswap do it inside. Obviously, still worth using an aggregator, because you're getting more than Uniswap, than just Uniswap. But now what aggregators are doing is looking into every single DEX and trying to figure out, why would a user still use an aggregator, even if the trade is routed only to one DEX, but it's still cheaper in terms of costs? Because if you execute the trade, those are on-chain transactions. The transactions you execute on the blockchain, and they have a cost that you pay to the Ethereum miners or whatever blockchain miners. And the more complex the code, like the more steps you do, sell to USDC, then sell to DAI, those are more steps, then more code, that's more gas, like more fees. And if the code is optimized, you will pay less fees by using directly an aggregator than using the underlying DEX directly. Or it's like, if you want, it's like when you go to Expedia sometimes, you pay less in Expedia, not often the case, but sometimes you pay less because they have like a special deals that give you a discount, or if you are a regular user, you can get a discount. Here, the equivalent is building an optimized code that will be less expensive than using the underlying DEX.
Interesting, interesting. And is this also more or less the same approach that all aggregators are also using, or how does one differentiate between fundamentally what is an aggregating solution?
Yeah, it is becoming a standard. I mean, it's not like a written standard, but it's mostly a way for aggregators to make it as much easier for users to use or like to choose the aggregators, and also make it less cheaper for users to use aggregators. So I would say those practices are almost done by all aggregators, like the vast majority. Some are new who still need some time to build those kind of features. But I would say the majority of DEXs, if it's not in production, it will be live, I would say, in the coming weeks or months.
Interesting. Martin, I saw you smiling at Manu's response before. Did you have something to add?
That was my sales pitch, if I do.
But yes, we will come to that as well.
No. Just interesting. Actually, I didn't know that when I that I can execute the trade cheaper through a paraswap, even if the order is only routed to one particular
that's
deck.
All so that is, was new like a curve.
Yeah, but
it's not possible with curve. Yep. You have to. There is no easy way to because curve is not. We don't use the router. We execute directly on pools. While Uniswap, you have to use a router in order to optimize the execution between pools. So the idea is how to build the most efficient router in order to make the execution as cheap as possible.
Yeah. No, makes a lot of sense. You know, I'm curious, did you do like a benchmarking, like if you look at costs of a DEX compared to centralized exchanges, for what pairs are actually DEX routers cheaper? Because, you know, like for the institutional adoption, I guess, like for example, we today as a bank, we route actually quite a lot of flow to, for example, OTC brokers and the likes. But I can also see that if like the transaction costs are continue to decreasing, if the user experience becomes even better, and potentially institutional players, they then also start actually executing directly through a DEX rather than through a centralized exchange. Whereas today, I think my working assumption would be actually most of the more institutional flows are actually still probably rather in the centralized exchanges or like OTC broker space, but which is also a central counterparty. So do you have any hypotheses on this, or like what is your analysis of the flows? Because I guess when you build something like you built, you also look a lot of data of who is using which tools and where are the flows going and where is the liquidity and the likes.
Yeah, so one way to compare is to take like a pair of tokens and look at the market depth. And the way we can do it is take what will be the market impact for a certain amount, and that will cause 2% slippage. That's like at least what CoinGecko uses, or as like the common like pattern that everyone uses to measure the market depth. It's 2% of market impacts. Like what is the amount that will cause more than 2% of market impacts? I look quickly, for instance, in Ethereum, I see from CoinGecko that Binance has 13 million market depth if you're buying ETH with USDT. And I went to Paraswap and it's 15 million. So you're doing a better deal on Paraswap than on Binance right now for ETH. Then it depends. That's for buy-in. For sell, I see that it's worse. That's 11 million only. So I believe that ETH and stablecoins and most ETH-based tokens are mostly, you will have better liquidity on decentralized exchanges than on centralized exchanges. Given what you were discussing in the beginning, this is permissionless, and projects can build their own liquidity independently from any third party. So now we're seeing much better market depth in decentralized exchanges than on centralized exchanges. Maybe Bitcoin is a bit harder first of all, there is no Bitcoin on DEXs. There is WBTC, like a wrapper or representation of Bitcoin. But for ETH and stablecoins, I would say yes, DEXs are, especially through aggregators, which maximizes the liquidity. I think are the right way for trading, I would say, large amounts.
Probably another factor that we have is, of course, transaction fees, and they are right now, they are low, given that there is not so much traffic on the Ethereum network right now. But of course, especially if you traded smaller lot size like half a year ago and you had gas fees of like 100 Gwei or the likes, then this was actually also a factor that you had to consider, like on top of the pure slippage that you face when you execute the trade.
Yeah, I would say the best tool would be something that would show you the liquidity on a centralized exchange and decentralized exchange. But obviously, the trick is exactly what you were saying, is to account for the gas, so that's the final price you get. But right now, yeah, it's not a big difference. For like $50 million, you would pay $100. It's fine.
That's actually a good segue. I mean, this is a genuine thing that I think a lot of people are curious about, is how dApps like Paraswap would function in a multi-chain world, and based also not just on different chains, but then also on different layer twos. Like, how does that kind of all come together? What does that mean for you guys?
Yeah, so we're already on 6 blockchains. A year ago, I think we were barely at 3. We're expanding more. We may have 8 to 10 from here to the end of the year. But I think it used to be, well, first of all, it used to be only an Ethereum game. Everyone was okay, but DeFi summer happened and the gas fees exploded. It went from being 50 cents to $1 to $100, $1,000. I saw some transactions for $3,000. Yeah. It became crazy. The thing is, market was highly demanding. There were a lot of opportunities on the market, yield farming and all of that. So that there was a huge demand on DeFi, but Ethereum wasn't able to fulfill that. Then we started having this big wave of L1s from BSC to Polygon to Avalanche and all of those. And some were just a hype and they started losing traction for various reasons. But some are staying and are growing. Obviously, BSC is still the biggest one. But we have Polygon, Avalanche, and now L2s, as we said. We have also a new trend for L2s like ZK EVMs. Where in ECC there was a button who created or like invented the ZK EVM, which is a funny discussion to follow. So aggregators are completely agnostic, and the benefits we have right now is those are all EVM based, which means it's the exact same code that we just deploy on another chain, like the smart contracts, and some configuration and some few integrations on the backend side for like integrating other DEXs. But the effort, I would say, it's not a rocket science. It's mostly if the underlying architecture is clean enough and scalable enough, it supports this modularity. So it's easy to scale to other chains. I would say now what we're talking about is mostly how to connect those chains, how to do cross-chain swaps between chains.
If you consider also like kind of the fragmentation of the liquidity as well, right? Like you can't have the same depth if you have this different instances in each chain or each pool.
Exactly. Yeah. That's because before it used to be one chain. We can compose various transactions into one transaction and achieve some very interesting results. Now we can't, because we cannot, a smart contract on Ethereum cannot call a smart contract with Polygon. So we have to find new ways to be more creative. The good news is that there is a lot of research, and it's hard from the hacks we were seeing on those bridges. Now we're talking like, I don't know, $2 billion that was hacked from bridges. But I would say this is scaling too quite fast. And maybe that's the reason why we had those hacks in the first place, because everyone tried to move very, very fast in order to capture those opportunities. But I believe that this is temporary. I believe that maybe a year, 2-3 years from now, we will have standards that will make a cross-chain transactions much more safer. The thing is, there are other chains that have solved those problems, but in their world, like Cosmos, they have this inter-blockchain communication. I think the first stable version was released a year or 2 years ago, and they've been working on that since 2016 or 15. So we have some standards that maybe we can look at and reuse, But definitely, this is the future of trying to solve this new fragmentation that we have created.
Yeah.
Also, layer twos, the like Ethereum layer twos, they are all built on top of Ethereum. So I would say if you're a layer two, interacting with DeFi on Ethereum is more easier and much, much more safer than if you are a Harmony trying to interact with Ethereum through a certain bridge.
Yeah, yeah. Martin, as long as you're looking at a crystal ball, how do you see this multi-chain, multi-layer universe unfold?
Yes, no, I think I see it almost exactly like Mooney, or like for me, it's also one of the key challenges now that the SVC liquidity now, of course, some is on Solana, some is on Avalanche, some is on BST. And of course, now if we would find means to aggregate the liquidity across all these protocols, or for example, also when we can call or when you can conduct an operation on the Ethereum blockchain without actually having to wrap something on a BST blockchain, on a Tezos blockchain, on a Cardano blockchain, then it makes probably enables many more use cases, and it also makes the user experience even simpler and the liquidity even deeper. Yes, but I think also here fair to say that this user experience with all these different layers and this interoperability, I think interoperability is a big topic, but if you look at it from a simple user perspective, and I'm not a techie, but I'm really just a simple user, I also have to say, like, it's taking too long, it's not intuitive enough, yes, there are hacks, you need to open like 10 wallets simultaneously to move funds from here to there. It's like a bit the Ether Delta of 2017. So I try to avoid it to the extent possible, and I really only make a transfer from a layer one to a layer two if I really, really have to. And otherwise, I just try to have everywhere a little bit liquidity so that I can carry out the operations that I need on these different layers whenever I want to. But actually, moving funds between different layers or between different blockchains is something that I try not to do very often. And then I also have to say, when I need to do this transfer, I actually very often use a centralized exchange, because the user experience today, well, of course, there are these bridges, but actually, yes, you can deposit into a Binance, and then you deposit on the Ethereum blockchain, you withdraw on the Polygon chain, and it's actually, it's fast, it's you don't need to wait, it's simple. The same with Binance Smart Chain, you can actually just simply withdraw an Ethereum to the Binance Smart Chain, it takes you 1 minute. But actually here, I also think I would prefer to do it decentralized, but decentralized, I so far, I didn't find a platform or any solution which I consider as intuitively and trustworthy as the centralized exchanges.
I love that.
So if Paraswap
can... That's a good feedback for DeFi to improve.
Yes.
No, but I love that. Like, we're still in the Ether Delta of multiple chains and layers, right? We're in the Ether Delta of bridging.
It makes a lot of sense, this analogy. I think it looks a lot like an Ether Delta. For someone who is not really used to use crypto DeFi like DEXs, it's super cumbersome. I totally agree.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we're already past 30 minutes, but I had one more question, and it's not related to what we were talking about before. So I'm going to make a slightly less smooth segue now. But I know that there's a lot of kind of movement now happening by DEXs and DEX aggregators, particularly towards institutional involvement or institutional participation. How do you see that happening? How can that be possible? Yeah, Munir.
Yeah, well, I believe that, well, first of all, DEXs are software made for everyone. So it can be end users, dApps, can be traders, bots, and various use cases. And obviously, institutions, they also have access to DEXs. Obviously, pragmatically speaking, well, institutions will not be using Uniswap tomorrow, maybe. Maybe some that have, but that's maybe the exception, not the rule. So legal departments will not be okay for a bank to use a DEX, like, I don't know, if we talk about Société Générale or Credit Suisse or some of those banks, they are building into crypto, but now we're asking them to trade on chain. So it's not going to happen tomorrow. So I believe that bridges can work very well. they are already familiar with using OTC, with using, well, I guess you mentioned earlier that you guys also are using OTC, also some exchanges like Binance or Coinbase, they have always in institutional products. So I believe now that large institutions have more confidence using crypto. They went from being dismissive and which is skeptical to now embracing crypto. And we have Signum that's crypto native bank. That's amazing that we couldn't imagine that before. So now we are getting into new phases where we bring in the technology that's worked very well on-chain, which is a software that allows exchange of swaps in a more secure way, like without a counterparty risk, and also in an efficient way, because as we were seeing, liquidity on Ethereum indexes is better than on centralized exchanges. So why pay more when we can pay less? Like, why not make a better trade when we have a choice? And that's obviously a fiduciary duty for those institutions. If you're a big hedge fund, you have the fiduciary duty to make the best possible transactions or trades. So having said that, it's not going to also happen tomorrow. So there has to be a bridge. And the bridge is to bring software that's using the same tech as decentralized finance, but it's not really decentralized. It is decentralized in some terms of security. So it's a smart contract that doesn't have custody and so on. But when we define decentralization, there are like three keywords: is trustless, permissionless, and censorship resistance. So trustless, it's trustless, of course, because we have the code is open source, it's audited, and it doesn't rely on a third party, but it is permissioned. Like, there has to be a counterparty. There has to be two parties trading with each other using smart contract instead of using a custodial that will make the matching between trades and maybe make it in a biased way. And censorship resistant, obviously it's not, so that doesn't feel that property. So it's like one out of three. And the goal in the future is to have maybe three out of three or maybe two out of three. We will see. So, but right now the value proposition is better prices and instant settlements. So exactly the same experience as using a decentralized exchange, where the moment the trade is final, the token, the counterparty, is immediately transferred to the trader instead of using an OTC where there is a mismatch or like a delay between the trading, the execution, and the settlement. Here, it works exactly as decentralized exchanges. But obviously, the main benefit is the prices, like having access to DeFi prices without really trading directly on DeFi.
Right. I mean, the idea of being able to have the benefits of DeFi, but with known counterparties, fundamentally, right?
Yes, at least that's our approach. There are other approaches, like the Aave Arc, where they took Aave, like Aave lending protocol with lenders and borrowers, and they created a permission pool where, as a consortium of institutions, can have lenders and borrowers, and they can be lending and borrowing from each other using the Aave formulas, like mathematical formulas that will determine the yield and determine the interest rate and so on. So that's also another approach. For us, we didn't choose to go with an approach like that with like an AMM, because I think that in order to get a new category of users to DeFi, it's very hard to ask them to do both the supply and the demand. It's going to take a lot of time. So here, at least, we figured out the supply. We're bringing DeFi supply that's compliant, and the new customers can just use a production-ready product that they can literally use immediately. So I think that's the approach we are taking, is there should not be too many steps. There are already a lot of barriers to entry, so let's reduce the barriers to entry as much as we can.
And Martin, coming from like the more traditional space, do you see this as being a thing that can that banks will happily jump onto, or how do you see this rolling out?
Well, for me, it's a bit the question is, do are we talking purely about crypto I think in the crypto space, some institutional adoption is probably already happening. Like, because like, yes, for us also, like, we are simply interested in good execution prices, and if you then see that decentralized exchanges provide constantly better liquidity and better prices than centralized exchanges, I think you will see that institutions move to the DeFi space. For me, to make this step into like traditional finance, institutional adoption, the question is probably also, will it be with a different underlying? You know, I wonder, for example, like we now also hear this topic of central bank digital currencies for a while. And for me, for example, this FX trading is also something where you don't want to have counterparty risk. You actually want to have this atomic settlement feature and the likes. And potentially, I think today the issue is a bit, there is only USDC. Now we see stable coins, for example, in the euro emerging and the likes. But I can imagine that the institutional adoption of crypto or the DLT technology suddenly happens with, like, yes, something new emerging like central bank digital currencies, because suddenly we potentially have a national bank depositing really, let's say, euro, and another national bank depositing Swiss franc, and then you can suddenly, a large bank can actually swap these currencies with almost unlimited liquidity through DeFi applications. And this might then suddenly be the application that really we see these traditional players entering the DLT space, because they really have a use case which is much, much better than what they have in the traditional finance space. Because for me, and that's not a question, DeFi, if you look at it, no counterparty risk, almost instant settlement, like, these are killer features, will make it to traditional finance. The question is just with what kind of underlying and at what point in time. But it's just a question of that, not a question if it happens, because the technology is clearly, clearly superior.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's like, we figured out the technology. So now we're proving, our argument is about proving that the tech is better. That's at least the discussions we have when we talk to these guys. But clearly, as Martin said, the next step will be to tell them, well, now here's the tech, use the tech, so let's now add in new use cases that are better using this technology than these obsolete traditional, I would say, finance technology that has been built in the 60s and the 70s. So I believe that's the right way to see it.
Yeah, and it's also always super exciting as a, you know, just working in the blockchain space over time to see it sort of creep into the mainstream in ways that you may not have assumed would be like the biggest first use cases, but still bringing the benefits of trustless transactions into mainstream finance. I love it. Guys, I think we're at the end of the time that we had allotted. Thank you both so much for coming on the episode today. I think it was a really nice dive into the way we are moving forward in DEXs, DEX aggregators, and also in the institutional space. And for our listeners, if you've got ideas about people we can have on the show, please write in to podcast@signum.com. And until the next time, I wish you a lovely day ahead.
Thank you.